I'm Ross Heide, and I'm with the Lutheran History Center of the West. And tonight we're going to be looking at congregational histories as one facet of religious history in the West. And there's so much that needs to be done that those of us who are related to this volunteer effort are ringing the bell and encouraging people to get busy in it as the opportunity presents itself. I would enjoy knowing, just to, as a starter, if as we go around you just share whatever church or religious group you're a part of, about how old is your congregation? How about you folks?
Well, it's Frohn Lutheran in little town Minnesota, Starbuck, and I would guess it's about 120 years old.
How about that? All right.
Wow.
How about you?
Royal Redeemer Lutheran Church, a suburb of St. Paul, Mendota Heights. Church is 30 years old, having our anniversary next month.
Well, fine.
Arlene Briel from Pullman, Washington. And I've been at a church 60 years.
60, yeah. All right.
I'm from Farmington Hills, Michigan. Our church was founded in 57. So it's 33 years old.
Very good. Heavy?
I'm sitting here trying to think how old the church is, and I don't know. The sanctuary is 25, but I don't know how old the church is.
It's a little over 35 about coming up, I guess. Way back there.
I'm Paul Willems from Rapid City, and our church is 6 years old.
Okay. Leo?
I'm the same one as several of us.
All right, very good.
60, but and then Lutheran Church of the Incarnation at Davis, where we were before.
That's right.
I think it's about 25.
And flourishing now, really doing well. You did a good groundwork.
Trinity Lutheran in Santa Barbara, it's 1904 it was found.
Okay, very good.
I'm Lois Erickson from United Lutheran in Eugene, and we were founded in 1926, and I was a charter member.
Well, marvelous. How about that? I know that church. The rather interesting architecture that they did. You know who, well, it was one of those, at the time that they built those cubes, you know, square churches,
yeah.
Rectangular.
Yeah, I was baptized in a church in Beverly Hills, and I think it was California, was organized in 1940, wasn't it?
Okay.
Ben and I went to the pastor, the chaplain of California Lutheran College in Thousand Oaks, California.
Sure.
And Bob Lawson started that Lutheran church in a Presbyterian Methodist combination sanctuary about 20 years ago, and Ted and I were charter members.
How about that?
We moved to Palm Springs 6 years ago, and now we're members of Calvary Chapel.
Fine. All right, how about the age of the other churches here represented?
We all three come from Pullman, and it hasn't aged a bit since.
All right. All right, how old the congregation that you're a part of, roughly?
91, we'll celebrate our 100th anniversary.
My, make a lot of us seem like kids. Well, that's marvelous. The reference to the prophet from Cincinnati goes back to a convention of the interesting group, the American Association of State and Local History. This is a group that has been meeting for some time as a gathering of people who are interested in bringing together history of really states or counties or communities, and then developing museums and centers, and then doing publishing. This group meets annually. Fact is, I was very disappointed to find that I just missed, I think, their silver anniversary, and they met in Washington, D.C. You can imagine they went full bore on that one. But this group puts out fine literature, and I'll pass this around. You can just browse at it. This is a listing of the materials that they produce, and some of this is usable by a congregation. But it shows the growing breadth of material that is being developed for the assistance of people involved and related to historical projects. At the meeting of the AASLH in San Francisco a few years ago. I happened to ride out to one of the field trips with a young man, and we got to talking, and he said something so perceptive and so stimulating that I said, would you please write that in a letter and send it to me? I would like to distribute it widely. So he said, surely I will. And in due time, the letter came. This man was with the Cincinnati Historical Society, and they had been going around section by section in the greater Cincinnati area, writing the history of each little community. And this is what he says. For the most part, the histories that have been produced by churches and synagogues is of very little use to general historians. Normally, they focus on the list of leaders, and they give a great deal of their attention to the construction of buildings. But they really tell very little about what that religious group has done within the community. And then this sentence has always lingered with me. Churches are influenced by the communities in which they exist, and the communities are influenced by the churches that are in them. Now, this has challenged me to carry the word out to people preparing histories of churches, to really go into depth into what is the ministry of the church. What is that congregation doing? What activities is that church involved in? How does it network with other community groups and other churches in ministering to the needs of the community? And you can see that this kind of thing would easily be overlooked within a church history. And yet if it is, it's a tragic reflection upon the fact that at times our religious groups have been rather ingrown, and they haven't been dedicated, as they might well have been at times, to serving outside their own community. And I don't want to deprecate the primary task that every congregation had at its beginning, which was to gather a group of people of a common faith and heritage and to assist them as they made their way in a new country. And the more you read about history, the more you realize that that community of religious faith, and often working shoulder to shoulder with people of other churches in the community, really helped newcomers find their way in a new world. It's been pointed out that you couldn't live in isolation in a farming community and get much done. I mean, the word barn raising was literally a description of what happened when the whole community came together and put together all the components of a large building like a barn. Or threshing. How many of us can say, I remember when the threshers came through? And what a time that was. That was more than threshing. That was socializing and consuming monstrous meals that were laid out on the table. And yet it was a neighborhood cooperative and a community event. So the churches very often have worked very, very closely with others. And in the first chapter, it was that group getting a toehold in a new world. Giants in the Earth by Rolvag shows some of these tensions, some of the reluctance to want to associate with people of other traditions. And that's just an actual fact of life. I like to share a story. I didn't realize in my hometown, Springfield, Ohio, that there was any kind of division within the Roman Catholic community. I knew that the big church downtown, St. Raphael's, St. Raphael's, was a strong church, but I didn't know out in another section of town was another Roman Catholic church, and downtown was the big Irish background, and out the other way was the German. And how did I learn that? Well, we got wind that one Sunday afternoon, the two Catholic high schools were going to have a football game. So we went out to see it. And I never saw such fervor. I mean, the Italians had to beat the Irish come, you know what.
And when they began to give way under the dominant strength of the other team, I saw those linemen crying as they couldn't keep those backs from splitting them open. Now, there were groups within the Catholic Church, and church history will let you begin to understand the dimensions not only of your own congregation, but of other religious groups, and how, if they're going to be accurate about their portrayal of their own congregation's history, they better tell it as it is. One of the couples that in the early years was often up here at Holden, I visited a few years ago, and I heard the wife of this beloved couple tell about the church history that was written of her Minnesota congregation, where they had long worshiped. And she said, when I realized what they had done in the history of our church's beginning, I was very unhappy. And what she referred to was this. One of the first pastors had a real problem with alcohol. But that was not honestly reported with any objectivity and with sensitivity. It was literally glossed over. And she said, that's not right to write history that isn't accurate and isn't open. And so this now is one of the delicate things you have to do. What do you do when one of the pastors is removed for personal difficulties? I have to face in the next few months the writing of the congregation that we started in Concord, California, and the third pastor there had not only an alcoholism problem, but some other problems. Now, do you just avoid it, or do you state something of the reality of it when you write this history? He admits now, very frankly and honestly, that he had developed a trouble. And he told me one day, he says, I was drinking $10 of booze a day. So you would have to admit he did have a problem. But when we write this story, as we tell the fine things that this fellow had done, how do we handle this? So I raise this just in passing as a challenge to the historian as they tell the story of the beginning years and then the growing years of a congregation. There are a few things I don't want to forget, and I'd like to make a note of this right now. Here's where the West isn't getting much help from Aid Association for Lutheran. AAL gives a special gift to congregations that reach their 100th anniversary. It's a gift of a sum of money that may be used in the publication of a history. And I think it's also for another time unit. And I don't think we have 25 churches in the Pacific states that have yet gone past that. We've now maybe 10, 12, 15, if you go all the way from the north down. And the oldest congregation in all the Pacific just celebrated their 150th. And we're going to talk about that on next Tuesday. Congregation in what was New Archangel, Alaska, and is now Sitka. And the oldest congregation, which Ev and I served for 12 years in San Francisco, goes back to 1849, and so it's now over 125. But we really, out in the West, our congregations are really pretty young. A lot of the churches, having been started in the 40s and 50s, you know where they are in preparing for anniversaries. But it's a significant challenge to see that a proper history of a congregation is released for an anniversary year. Because what better way could you celebrate it than to pay tribute to those that helped establish a church long ago? I have here two books. You can't bring your whole library up, but I just picked two. These happen to be from Hawaii. This is a history of the Lutheran Church of Honolulu, 40 years, and it was written by Bernard Horman. Now, Bernard Horman is a very, very capable sociologist and historian. His father came to Hawaii and to Honolulu to serve the parish there, and I took Bernard's oral history
four years ago, I think, and he passed on last year. I see that I have two copies of this, and I'll just pass them around and let you look at them. His background and his readiness to write an accurate history of this is enhanced by the fact that he had written a book called The Germans in Hawaii. And as a sociologist, he made a detailed study of the record of the Germans who had come over to the islands. And so within the congregational history, its sensitivity to that is enhanced by his wide knowledge of this. He lectured for many years at the University of Hawaii and was a very respected sociologist. Of interest to some of you is the fact that as he was doing his doctoral study at the University of Chicago, he met the famous historian, wasn't it Henry Breasted, the archaeologist, historian of the Middle East? Well, he met his daughter, their daughter, and a friendship developed and they were married. And so the two of them were a part of the community there in Honolulu for many years. Another book, which is very, very well done, was written by a young woman, Catherine Lowe. Her family came to the islands as a part of an immigration of Filipinos, and they settled on the island of Kauai. She went through college there. She came onto the States, and she got her master's from the University of Washington in library science. She's a librarian for the college in Luhui on the island of Kauai, and she spent a good deal of time researching this and doing a very excellent story. And I'll let you just take a look at this and be alert to how they did the history of the oldest Lutheran church in the Hawaiian Islands. I would like you to share with me now. Let's all play the fact you're on a history committee of your congregation, and you have to write a history, an anniversary history. And let's say that the sad truth is that the historical records of your congregation either were not well kept, or maybe were wiped out by a fire, and that has happened. Well, you're going to dig it out. I think it would be fun to be a committee of the whole. And let's do some work on this. How would you get that material? Is this a piece of chalk? No. We are almost at the point where we're going to have to be using fingernails to write on this. And I thought it would be fun to put up here in front of us the sources of history that you would seek if you were going to write that history for your congregation. Where would you find the materials? Where would the resources be?
Charter members.
Charter members. Where would you find the list?
With the secretary?
The church secretary? Right. Now, let's not demand that we make it as hard as we can. But for a backup, if those things were not there, where might they be found as a backup source?
In a safe.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Abby, can I co-opt you and ask you to do some writing here? And we'll just put a list of the sources for such material, and I think it would be helpful to us, because you'll surely think of some that some others don't.
How about a
okay,
safe?
Let's say parish records, church minutes. What else?
Well, talk to the charter members themselves.
If it's young enough that they're around, that's excellent. And this could mean then charter members, and that could mean you'd be taking oral histories. And that's not only a valuable, but it's even an exciting experience to take that. All right? What else?
Maybe a county historical society.
Right, county historical society, and that's a surprising source of material. Catherine Lowe, who's a historian for this congregation, had just finished a project at the community college where they had gone through all of the Lihue newspapers and listed by subject the feature articles
going back to all the copies that they had in the historical museum. You can imagine how valuable that would be, to be able to go back and look up either personality or historical events, which surely were covered in the newspaper of the town. I was at the church 2 weeks ago. Abby and I went over to St. Mark, San Francisco, and it was an anniversary celebration, and I gave a talk about the redevelopment years when we were there and rebuilt the whole block, and they brought out the page of the newspaper when they dedicated the new church in 1894. You can imagine there's an interest in that kind of thing, okay? Historical Society, we've slipped that into newspapers. Where might other material be found?
Would the early church bodies, I mean, when they first got together, have some?
Yes, I would say that there could well be in the mission records of the founding Lutheran body that initiated your church some valuable information about the beginning years of your congregation's history. Where could you find pictures?
Other members of the community that weren't even members of the church.
Well, you might have that. That's right. But how about the members?
Confirmation pictures.
Yeah, if you dig out confirmation pictures, and if there is not a file in the parish, you could find from the various families and perhaps get a loan of those pictures so that they could be used for putting in the book or displayed historically. What else?
Our church in Beverly Hills, our Lutheran church, in May sent out a letter to all of us older members.
Right.
And most of us have moved away, saying, we're celebrating our 50th anniversary. Would you please send pictures of you now? And would you send a little one-page letter of something that you remember about the church and then mail it to this lady who's making up a, well, church history, but a nice file.
Did you respond to that?
Yep, but I didn't have a picture because we got the mail as we were already on our vacation.
I see.
The letter followed me, so I did write.
This does indicate that if you really want people to be able to do it, should give them enough lead time that they can really search it out. I fear too many of us have boxes of photographs from different chapters of our history, and not always have they been organized. Tell my wife all about it. I spent 3 days going through boxes of photographs and putting them together by topics and dates and chapters. All right, what else? Is there any possibility you think you might find any movies? What was the big fad about 20, 25 years ago in America?
8 millimeter
movies. One congregation in Orinda was surprised to find that one of the charter members, who's still active in that church, had taken 8 millimeter movies of the construction of the building, of the dedication, of many of the major events in the history of the church. And so now they've done what you can imagine they would. They've had those made into VHS cassettes, and now that congregation has a valuable collection of history that they would not have had if that person had not been interested in taking pictures of the church. And that meant that that person had gotten confirmation pictures and a number of other pictures with some dimension and depth. What else?
Well, I'm wondering if the local Lutheran academies and universities and their history and religion department might have papers that might have been done for a master's thesis or even a senior paper or something they might have in their archives about some churches.
That's an interesting suggestion. I hadn't thought about theses, but I went to the University of Washington and talked to the manuscripts person, and I found that they do have some Danish materials in there and a couple other specialized things, but in the colleges and seminaries, you may find that some students have done theses, maybe on their home church, you know. And at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, there is one very, very helpful thesis on the Lutheran presence in the Pacific Northwest, which would mention specifically all of the early churches, and in some cases gives some specific information that would be helpful. All right, the colleges and the universities. State archives at times have valuable materials. Unfortunately, the archives for the state of Oregon were kept within their library, and back about 1928 they had a fire which destroyed most of them. And they had to go out and seek parallel sources and duplicate the materials that they had lost. But the archivist for Oregon now, who happens to be a Lutheran layman, Roy Turnbaugh, tells me that, you know, they do have some of this material. And that's a place where you could find, surprisingly, some helpful information. I would feel that you've already now exhausted the primary sources. The one thing that you might be surprised at is that the synod offices, in some synods, have had effective volunteer archive committees, and the finest West Coast collection of Lutheran materials I have found is in the North Pacific District of the Missouri Synod. Their archivist, Carl Nitz, showed me their materials. They have files, metal files, with a good folder on every congregation in the district. And he pulled them out and showed me that they had on every church documentation, the letters relative to the calls of the pastors, site acquisition, dedication of property, dedication of first unit. And while we were there for a couple of hours one afternoon, a committee of two women came from a congregation that was beginning to search for material for an anniversary. And so he paused and he pulled out their material and he laid it out before them, and their eyes just sparkled, because here was much of the material that was needed by that church, and it had not been well kept and organized in their own congregation. So in the office of your own synod, or it used to be district or conference, but now you have the districts of the Missouri Synod and you have the synods of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, you may find helpful materials that will enable you to do that. What do you think you should put in your congregation's history? Let's think of it from an overview. What might be the opening statement of it?
Early pastor.
All right, early pastors. I reminded of the four cartoons that I saw the other day. It's a Peanuts cartoon, and it shows a little girl, and she's telling her little friend in the cartoon, "I'm going to write the history of my church." He says, "It's going to be a very good history. I'm going to start way back at the beginning. Our pastor was born in 1930. In other words, she thought that it was focused around them. Behind that arrival of the pastor and the initiating of the congregation, what else might be put in as a kind of introduction to it?
Maybe the charter from the mission board setting up.
All right.
All right. Here.
Now you're talking literally about the specific congregation. I'm feeling and fishing for something about the setting of that church.
Well, where the first services were held.
All right. Now you're going into the chronology, and that's good. We really ought to keep that in it. I'm thinking, what did they do up in the mine, the Porto Museum? They don't start with Holden Village. They don't even start just with the mine. What else do they put up there?
Well, who first stumbled onto the place?
Right, but beyond, before that. What are those first maps and displays up there?
Oh, they're going to build a railroad through
here. All right. But you see, that's still pretty close-up vision.
The prospectors coming through.
Right. And they even...
The geology of it.
The geology of the region. That's right. And the maps of the region. So that it comes into a setting. And that's the kind of thing which I feel a number of the congregational histories don't take time to set the scene. What is this region of the country to which they came? What was it that was bringing people here? And what was it that attracted the people to this region? And then this group of people came. And then you go into who were they? And then you go into the things you talked about. What is the action of a Lutheran body, perhaps, that sent out a pastor? Or, and you'd be surprised, a number of these churches were not actually started by a pastor. But the lay folk gathered together in their homes, and they met for worship and devotion. They had services led by lay leaders, and then they went out and sought pastoral leadership. This is especially true of those people of the Scandinavian Haugian tradition. The old church that's now on the campus at Luther College was started by lay folk who had to go out and find a pastor. And that's a rather exciting story. So I would suggest that. Then now, we're at that point, and now some of you said, you know, how about the action of the Lutheran body that authorized this? And then who were the first leaders who came out here in the 40s and were working in missions in the 40s and 50s have begun to think it might be interesting to have a reunion and bring together those of us still alive. And we'd meet to reminisce and then to record. A reunion for remembering and recording. Because some of the stories of the sacrifices of those young couples that came out, and they left all their family and all their friends and came out far away. And I remember talking to a pastor working out in a suburb of Phoenix. And he was telling me this was in the days before air conditioning. But he used to carry a whole jug, gallon jug of water, and he'd go out in the afternoon to make calls. And he says, before I was finished, I had drained that whole gallon jug of water because it was hot and no air conditioning. He was out making survey calls to gather together people to form a congregation. Now that's just one thing. The Lutheran president of the Pacific Northwest tells some of the stories of those people who walked, who often didn't have a horse. I remember reading a story of a Pastor Young down in San Jose who went down to do survey, and he had a bicycle. And he bicycled all around this community, and finally he gathered enough families, and he had a group together, started one of the first Lutheran churches in San Jose, California. A very, very amazing record of, you know, he had to live within the time with the means they had, with the transportation that was available. It was interesting. Of course, they make fun, you know, of the Methodists came out with the wagon trains. Not all the Lutherans came with the first bands of settlement, the pastors. But the Episcopalians poked fun at themselves. I've heard an Episcopalian bishop say, well, we didn't come with the wagon trains, and we didn't come with the early settlers. No, Episcopalians waited until the trains were here, and we came out riding Pullman. And it's all right for them to poke fun at themselves. But that's part of the story. The other story one of the bishops shared that I thought was interesting. Two of the pastors from one community had to travel to a neighboring some distance for the Methodists were going to have a meeting and the Episcopalians were going to have a meeting, a convention in the spring. And as they got off the train when they got to this city, why the Methodist was walking from the day coach section, and as he got near the Pullman section, off stepped his neighbor, the Episcopal priest. And so the Methodist decided that he would rub it in, and he said, well, I can see that you're spending the church's money. And he says, I slept on the day coach. I sat up last night. I was saving my church's money. And the Episcopal looked at him and grinned, and he says, when I was taking care of the church's servant. And he boasted that he was doing it, spending a little money, but he is getting there fit and fresh. So every tradition has its heritage, has its budget limitations, and has its silly stories. Now, you have the story of beginnings. You have this. Was there ever any turmoil in any early churches?
Yeah.
Were there ever any factions within them?
Yeah.
What were some of those tensions stem from? What did they stem from?
Lodges.
Yes, there was a very, very strong disagreement about secret orders and lodges. That's right. Were there different groups of one nationalistic body? I have read that in Ballard in Seattle, at one time there were 11 Scandinavian churches, and most of them Norwegian. There was such lack of coordination with the three Norwegian groups in America that they were planting schools in opposition of each other and planting churches in opposition of each other. And the ultimate experience that Ev and I had came to us in 1948. We were sent on a little tour in northern Iowa. It was December 1948, and we came to the town of Lake Mills, population 1,500. And there are three Lutheran churches in there. I couldn't believe when I learned they were all three Norwegian Lutheran churches in a town of 1,500. And they were the three major groups. You know, one from the state church, and one from a more moderate, and one from a Lutheran free with a strong Haugian flavor. Now, if you have the history of a church in its formative years, it's probable that some of those threads of dissension are within it. And do you think they should be reported if evidence is there of it? It's not only accurate, but it's even humorous to us now, but it wasn't to them. And so you have this. There is a two volumes back in the far shelf in the reading room, Norwegian Immigration in North America. And I spent a half hour just before lunch there filling out some of the stories of the first Norwegians that came over here and settled either in Fox River near Chicago or else up in three communities in Wisconsin, and some of the struggles. They got in the hands of some real estate promoters, and they were guided to go over here. It's better land, you know, than down there. That's very poor. The most amusing thing I read was a group trying to promote them to come over to the land they wanted to move, and they said, here are two Norwegians, and they have lived in these different areas, and here was a tall, lanky, hollow-cheeked fellow, and says, he lived for a while down in Fox River, but this fellow lived up here in Wisconsin. He was a healthy, ruddy, cheeked fellow of real vigor, and that swung the deal, and all those Norwegians moved on over into Old Muskego. And it was delightful in the summer, but they found in the spring there was an awful lot of water and a lot of marsh and a lot of mosquitoes and a lot of malaria and a lot of funerals. And so after a while they moved, you know, on up near Dane County and started another church. But you must dig into these histories, and you must put these pieces together, and then you begin to get an accurate story of what happened in these settings. Is it important to record the building of the early buildings? Was it easy for them to build those buildings? How'd they do it?
Volunteer labor, most of them.
A lot of it. They didn't have much cash. So you find that one of them would give land, another would give a certain amount of materials, some would give timber, and all of them would give the strong backs of the men of the family, and the women would do the cooking, and they'd gather and they'd build their first unit. And some of them had high hopes and high standards. What did they want beside a church?
And schools.
Yeah, and?
The parsonage.
Parsonage and?
Community cemetery.
Cemetery.
Very interesting that many, many of the rural churches would always have a cemetery near the church. And that was a part of it. The fact is, one of the most significant historical Scandinavian churches in Minnesota has been made now into a state monument and is kept now by the state. And often the families come back, and there is the building, and it's all well kept, and there is the cemetery next to it. And this is a part of, they were facing the fact they were coming to stay. And funerals were a part of life, and a cemetery was needed. I'd like to ask a question. How many of you now, where you live, are able on a Sunday afternoon to drive to your grandparents' graves? Tells a lot about how we've moved, doesn't it? How far do you have to go to visit grandparents' graves from your home?
Norway.
All right.
Åland Islands.
Where?
Åland Island between Sweden and Finland.
All right.
1,500 miles.
1,500?
150.
150? 2,000.
600.
600.
1,000 and 3,000.
All right. For me, it's Ohio. For Evie, it's Trenton, New Jersey. Some people have suggested that this very fact, the fact that little children are not able to be taken out to visit grave sites, has deprived them of a sense of tradition and roots. As a little boy, I remember my father taking me to the little cemetery down by Paint Creek in Fayette County, not far from Columbus, near Washington Courthouse, and walking me through there and showing me the grave of old Joseph Heide, who had come, you know, born in Philadelphia and lived in Highland County, Virginia, and had come up and worked in Ohio and went up and bought land, and then he showed me his sons and then his father's grave and where he would be buried. Strong impact on me. Strong impact on my life. And I point this out because I think we're doing a lot more than writing a history. We're creating a sense of heritage. We're talking about values. We're saying thanks to those whom Paul Empey said we're all standing on our grandparents' shoulders. We're all the beneficiaries of their labors and sacrifices. And so every exercise in history is an experience in gratitude. And that's something that we should remember. What other things should we put in our history?
Well, humorous events also.
I think it would be helpful, wouldn't it, to put in the fun things, the celebrations, and those things that took place. It depends on how much space you have and how many pages you have to use. What do you think about the fact that some histories will put in things like the officers of the congregation, and the leaders of the women's group, and Sunday school leaders over the decades? Is that valuable?
Yeah.
It recognizes their labor and their service, doesn't it? What else?
I just thought of another one. You know, most of the churches put through recipe books to women, and sometimes right. They have a little history in there.
That's a good point. Yeah. That phrase, have a little history in there, reminds me of one thing I wanted to remember to tell you. I don't know where I got the idea, but every church puts out an annual report, doesn't it? And for too many churches, it's a chore and not an opportunity. And so Ev can tell you that one of the things we do all through the year is keep records and keep pictures. And every annual report, we try to put a page of pictures front and back, the highlight pictures of the year. Then on the inside, a little description of what those events were and who was involved. And then, very first thing, a section of highlights of 1989, or whatever it was, and there by month, the events of worship and other things within the life of the church. And I want to tell you how valuable it is. A week ago Saturday, we met with about 30 young adults that came together for a reunion, our San Francisco parish. This was one of the closest-knit groups of people in any parish we ever served. These people came from all around the Midwest and East, and they became a group that was formed when three girls came to Parsonage one Sunday night, and I was asking them, how's it going? And they said, not so good. He says, there's really no place to meet people. I don't want to meet people in bars, and that's about the only option we have. So they got their heads together and we chatted. I guess Evie may remember because she's probably there, and we wondered how we could get people together. We decided that the next Sunday after church, we had a coffee hour every Sunday, we'd have an announcement made that the young adults were going out to eat together. Dutch treat. Well, the first day maybe 8 went out, and then 12, and it ended up 30 or 40 would go out. But the interesting thing was, the first Sunday they came to an inner city church, they had a place to go and eat with somebody. And of course, if they were new to the city, when the dinner was over, what are you going to do? Well, I don't have any plans. Let's go out to Golden Gate Park. So they would go out to Golden Gate Park, either on the bus or if there was a car or two, and that wasn't very probable. But then they'd spend the afternoon together, and then one of the girls that had an apartment would say, hey, come on, let's come over to our house and make, or our apartment and make waffles. And so they would do that. And there evolved an intimacy and a friendship that grew over the years. I remember one Christmas Sunday morning in the choir that three girls were grinning and showing off their engagement rings. And we had marriages and we had fellowship. And this became a leadership pool that enriched that congregation in a way that was just unbelievable. I recall that group produced solos for our choir. At one time, 5 soprano solos, 3 altos, 2 tenors, and 2 baritone basses. And a music program was strengthened. They served in other ways, but they got together, and as they did, I opened this one year, and I just skimmed through the highlights of this 1967. And this group came in about 5 times during the year. Told about their May visit to Yosemite National Park for a weekend and other retreats they had in October down in Santa Cruz Mountains and other events. That record was there, and as we wanted to reflect on what happened, all I did was open the annual report and there it was. So it's a source of memories. The other thing is, if you give your membership an annual report that has pictures and they're in it, they're not going to throw that annual report in a wastebasket. That'll be in their to keep shelf in their church. And it doesn't take very much to do it. And its cost is really rather minimal. And then if you want to have fun, you can run off extra copies and use the other side for personal letters. And people love to have it. How else can you make history visible other than that anniversary book? What can you do in your church? Yeah.
Well, one thing I do is I write notices for the newspaper of what's going to happen at church.
Yeah.
And so it's just little things like this,
right.
Every couple weeks probably. And so then I cut them out and I paste them on typing paper, and when I get a bunch of them, I take them and they put them in the archives.
Good for you. In other words, you keep a flow of materials into your church archives.
Someone that's come to speak, you know, to adult Sunday school, or a missionary that's come and there's preaching, or some special event, or our new intern pastor that should be in. Oh, this is Saturday. It should be in the paper today.
Okay, excellent.
And
Lois brings up a good point. In many congregations I've visited, and I've spoken at a lot of anniversaries, there's usually somebody like Lois that keeps things.
That's right.
And a lot of people may not know about it, but they've kept good records. I could go take you down to Davis. I was just there the other day at that Lutheran Church of the Incarnation where we charter members. And there's a lady there that didn't like the way they were keeping the records, and she's reorganized the whole affair.
Wonderful.
So you know everything that's happened. And I know there's in other churches that this has happened, and you, if you can promote them to have anniversaries more frequently than every 50 and every 100.
Oh my, yes.
You know, but I was going to say, where my mother was confirmed after she came from Norway, the Fur Conway Church. I don't know if some of you know Fur Conway Church.
Yeah.
And it's a delightful congregation, and they invited me to come back And what was very helpful to me before I went there, and the person that organized it is a, she leaves nothing to chance, and she had to, everybody there on Saturday to get ready for Sunday. But before I went down there, I went to the cemetery and walked through the cemetery. And of course, a lot of the people I knew, and it was helpful in my presentation.
I bet it was.
Yeah. And so you find out, of course, as you go back to their anniversaries, you know, which anniversaries you had, and somebody put a lot of work in, usually, on these. Some have audio tapes on them.
Now, I'm glad you said that, because there's the other thing, which he's now opened this other field, the field of oral history. Audio tapes. How did they use audio tapes at the celebration you went?
I remember.
It's now a growing technique of recording history. It's a matter of videotape. And they not only take the celebration and the service and the messages and the luncheon or dinners that they have, but they get the old timers together and they interview them one at a time or put a couple of them together to get spin-off. And there they kind of feed each other and stimulate each other. And some of the things that come out there are just wonderful. So you have a rare opportunity to capture some of these memories on videotape. And it's just powerful what it does. And think of its value in 10, 15, 20 years when you can't call them in anymore. But that's a tremendous, exciting thing.
I think at the Burr Conway, I think somebody recorded it because it was an unusual event. I asked them if they didn't have a children's sermon, and they said, well, we had a pretty big load there already. And I said, do you have an idea? And I said, yeah, my wife will do a demonstration with her hearing dog. Well, you can imagine the Scandinavian community.
I bet.
The church is full, you see, and I waddle in with my wife and her dog, her hearing dog, you know, and yes. All those Scandinavians looking down, you know, they've gone 200 years, never seen a dog in
no.
A church before, you know, and sure. They're pretty shook up about it, and then they bark, and that didn't help. But then we did a demonstration, and I went out behind the pulpit and hid out there after I introduced all the kids to my wife and her dog, and she was telling them how the dog functions, it does all these various things, and then she says, and for the door, if they ring the doorbell, or knock on the door, and I knocked on the door back there, and of course the dog jumped on her and took her back to where I was, and it made believers out of the whole congregation.
Oh.
And when we went, I took her back to meet the congregation, a lot of them came back and petted the dog on the way down and invited it down for a strawberry shortcake.
Well, that's education at its finest.
Thank you.
Of course, that's a gift that Leo had. It's marvelous.
You know, one thing that's going down in our church history that we came to our old church in 1917. The men sat on the right-hand side, the women on the left. And they did that until 1932 when we got married. We're sitting together.
Ah, good. So you broke the taboo. Wonderful for you. All right, any other ideas as we wrap up?
I suggest we had a choir director leave after 10 years, and they had about a half-hour ceremony for her. That was all videotaped.
Yep.
That videotape could be placed in the archives of the church.
Sure.
Eventually it'll be part of the history.
This idea of thanking a person who's been in a church, especially in any kind of role, leadership, as they leave, and they do periodically, letting that be a milestone and mark it and celebrate it and record it, that's wonderful. All of those things humanize and personalize the church, which really is, should be a family of friends about the work of the Lord.
That together, as they leave, or before they leave, then there are many pioneers almost who might be 80, 90
right.
Now, and we should get them on either video or oral tape before they leave.
Absolutely. And there is a real discipline program to do that. Are you aware of the Pacific Lutheran University project of the Scandinavian immigration experience? Janet Rasmussen has been working on this, assisted by a grant a few years ago from the Skaggs Foundation. And she told us a week ago, Wednesday, at PLU, that they have now been gathering this material and sorting it out, and two books are being prepared to be published on the Scandinavian immigration experience in the Pacific Northwest. And it's important that we gather this material on cassette and then transcribe it so that it's ready in text form as well as just on the recording.
It has an ease of research and checking if you're looking for information. But that's important. In the next days ahead of us for next week, we'll be looking at the history of the Lutheran Church in Alaska, then in Hawaii, and then in the Southwest, and then give a special time to the whole field of family history. And the last one, I'm going to show a couple samples of simple family histories been gathered, and pay some tribute and read little excerpts of those. I'll say something about the whole technique of oral history and some of the things that have been learned and the way in which it can be enhanced. And I'd like to share with you a few comments about a book that's been written by someone over in Bainbridge, Joyce Stewart, with her friend Mary Croft, The Leisure Pen, a book for elder writers. Very helpful book that's starting to be discovered and be used. This is Willa Baum's classic handbook on transcribing and editing oral history. Willa Baum's with the University of California's Bancroft Library, and she's one of the co-authors of this oral history anthology, along with David Dunaway. So looking ahead to next week, we'll be talking about that. I'll say a few words about John Thompson, who's Snowshoe Thompson, written up a 1959 in the Reader's Digest article, where he's called Snowshoe Thompson, the Paul Bunyan of the High Sierra. Happy to report, following a hunch, we checked with his home community in Telemark, Norway, and got the material back on his baptism and early church history, and found out things we hadn't known, and now we've sent back things to that community that they didn't have, and we're digging out, preparing for another little book on this fascinating Norwegian who came and was in the gold rush years in the area up above Sacramento in Placerville, which was then called Hangtown. I have here copies of our little volunteer program, the Lutheran History Center of the West. George Muti King is active in this, as I mentioned. He's our secretary. A retired pastor, George Norman, is our treasurer, and Roland Swanson up in the Pacific Northwest in Mount Vernon is on our executive committee, and then all the archivists of the West Coast are in it. And this is the story of our little pilgrimage as we year by year tried to expand what we were doing and also tried to learn what we should be doing. And they have these. If you want to pick one up, you might find it interesting to you. This is, as I said, just a volunteer movement. A few years ago in the Pacific Lutheran University had a two-day workshop writing congregational history. It was put together by Milt Nesbig. Dear Milt's funeral was last Thursday, you know, at PLU. We were, strange thing, close friends. We happened to be up right after he had passed on, and all of the archivists who were there for a conference were able to go to that celebration of his life at the University Church Trinity there on last Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And this is called The Lutheran Presence in the Pacific Northwest, Writing Congregational History. It's my only copy of this, but it's a very helpful little book. And those things are a part of the resources that we could turn to.